Greetings and introgressions, my fine feathered listeners, and welcome to this March 2013 Science News Update. I'm your host for this wondrous wonder of wonderful science podcasts, Jim Campanella. We are just so brimming over with stories tonight. I will waste no time at all with preliminaries, but just get on with this. As usual, a couple of you loyal listeners have been on the lookout for science stories, so I've got two listener-submitted stories this evening. The first is from C.J. Urso, one of my former graduate students. C.J. wanted to make sure that I got the update on the Bigfoot DNA story that I mentioned here a couple of months back. You may remember that I reported on Dr. Melba Ketchum, Texas veterinarian, who told the world that she had isolated and characterized Bigfoot DNA from tissues collected throughout North America. You may remember at the time that I told you that Ketchum had not yet published her findings, but was trying to get a manuscript published that characterized her data. Well, as it turns out, Ketchum's manuscript never got through the peer review process to get published. Apparently, she was rejected out of hand by a number of journals. Well, apparently, the good Dr. Ketchum has a never-say-die personality because she decided she would publish by hook or by crook. She would not accept any scientists from questionable places like universities threatening the credibility of her studies. So, in order to battle the obvious anti-Bigfoot bias out there, Ketchum purchased a scientific journal to publish her results after all the other journals had rejected her paper. The journal is called De Novo Scientific Journal, and apparently Ketchum's paper is the only one published there, and the only article that has ever been published by it. Of course, the article still gives genetic evidence based on collection of purported Sasquatch samples that Bigfoot is not a new species, but a hybrid of human females and an as-yet-unidentified primate species that mated 13,000 years ago. The abstract of the paper says the team of scientists examined 111 blood, tissue, hair, and other samples collected in 14 U.S. states and two Canadian provinces, and extracted DNA and mitochondrial DNA. The 11 researchers, who decided they would link up their fates with Ketchum, titled their paper, Novel North American Hominids, Next Generation Sequencing of Three Whole Genomes and Associated Studies. In a commentary published February 13th on her Sasquatch Genome Project website, Ketchum wrote, quote, "It has been a long and tedious battle to prove that Sasquatch exists. The mainstream scientific community possesses the worst scientific bias in the peer review process in recent history," unquote. She then equated her treatment with that of Galileo, who was imprisoned for saying that the sun did not revolve around the earth, and stated, quote, "We did finally pass peer review with a relatively new journal," unquote. Of course, in that particular statement, she does not go on to actually point out that she acquired the journal and renamed it. Although eventually she does come clean and even links her website to another that says that it is ethical for journal authors to serve as their own editors. The journal De Novo proclaims itself to be a peer-reviewed journal, but Ketchum says that she is using peer reviews from a previous journal that rejected the manuscript. I have no idea how that could possibly be or what that means. I wanted to download a copy of this paper to judge its scientific worthiness for myself, but I discovered another seriously weird thing about this entire situation. De Novo claims to be an open access journal. That normally means that a publication's papers are available to the public for free, and the journal makes its money by charging the authors whose papers have been accepted. However, De Novo is charging $30 a pop for that Sasquatch paper. Yeah, I was a bit annoyed. Not only is this woman bypassing the normal publication process by vanity publishing her own paper, but she is also profiting on the paper and making it that much harder for the scientific community to really evaluate her work. I'm not sure whether this woman is ignorant of the way real science works or is just throwing her outre ideas in the face of the scientific community as an insult, or is simply a nit that neither knows nor cares about scientific opinion on her work. I'm being careful not to call the work a complete fantasy, but frankly, I can't judge its fantastical elements because I will not pay $30 for potential twaddle. We better get on to the next story before I blow a blood vessel. Listener Mark Zanfardino decided I should try my hand at the zombie craze while I still could, so he sent me this article from Sandia National Laboratory in New Mexico. Dr. Kerr has just reported his Sandia work with zombie cells in the proceedings of the National Academy. Kerr has come up with a way of essentially making robot cells, starting with living tissue. The article calls them zombie cells, but zombie would simply imply that they are dead and still performing living tasks. I have a feeling some brilliant journalist thought to call them zombie cells to help cash in on the zombie craze and get readers, but calling them zombie cells is just plain silly. It seems to be that what Kerr did was closer to the process of making a robotic Maria in Metropolis. How is that for an old reference? So what did he do? Well, he took mammalian cells and deposited silica on them, essentially glass. The researchers then heated the cell up to burn off its protein. It seems to be something akin to making a 3D image using a mold. Basically, once all the protein is gone, he's left with an exact 3D representation of the cell in silica. The resultant hardened silica structures are faithful to the exterior and interior features of the formerly living cell and can survive greater pressures and temperatures than any type of living flesh ever could. He says, quote, "These structures are three-dimensionally stable forms that resist shrinkage even upon heating to over 500 degrees centigrade. The refractoriness of these delicate structures is amazing," unquote. He also says that these weird silica cell forms can perform some functions better than when they were alive. And here's where I begin to question the man's sanity. One of the things that proteins do is act as biological chemical catalysts. That is, they reduce the amount of energy needed to perform chemical reactions. This is actually an important function. Cells in general cannot survive the hundreds of degrees of temperature necessary to carry out most chemical reactions that you would do in a laboratory. They would die. In order for enzymes to act as catalysts, they have to have specific three-dimensional shapes and be able to change shapes as they interact with biochemicals. I have to admit I am unclear whether Kerr is just using the silica system to quickly preserve the inside of the cell, DNA, proteins, and all for use and examination later, or whether he is implying that the silica structures will work just as well as proteins do. If that is what he's saying, it makes no chemical sense to me. I guess part of my confusion lies in that Kerr is a materials scientist, an engineer essentially, and I'm a biological scientist. And I think we simply are not speaking the same language. For example, Kerr says, quote, "Since structure is important to function, stabilizing a catalyst in shape it evolved is important. Heat-hardened silica would stabilize and protect the still-present protein as it did its work," unquote. So I just don't get it. Did the protein get burned away or didn't it? His earlier description says that the protein was burnt off. Was it or wasn't it? Was it just the surface protein that was burnt off? And if it was the surface protein, the outer layer of a cell is not protein, it's mostly lipid, fat. And if he's talking about the protein, the enzyme being covered by silica, then there's no way that a substrate, whatever the protein is working on, can actually access it. It would be like being covered by a glass box. I believe that what Kerr is talking about is maybe a partial burning off at lower temperatures, because he talks later on about a much more complete process that leaves a true mold of the cell in silica. He says that heating the cell to higher temperatures, greater than 400 degrees Celsius, evaporates all the organic material of the cell and leaves the silica in a kind of wax replica of a formerly living thing. The hardened silica-based cells display internal mineralized structures with intricate features ranging from nano to millimeter length scales. I think what Kerr is saying is very interesting. He's implying that one can preserve cells using his silica method so that substructures can even retain activity later if the silica is removed. But I'm not so impressed. To me, he's just describing a high-tech kind of embalming process. Okay, so part of my problem with Kerr may be based on communication issues between different kinds of scientists. But there are more fundamental types of communication problems that arise every day between people. I'm talking about communication between men and women. My wife will attest that we speak different languages. She will say one thing, and I will entirely misinterpret it, or not understand what she is getting at all. I suspect many men and women have experienced this. Well, Dr. Margaret McCarthy at the University of Maryland has just published a paper in the Journal of Neuroscience that examines why men and women, especially at an early age, do not communicate so well. McCarthy's paper suggests that levels of the brain protein, FOXP2, which is associated with language acquisition in humans, as well as vocalization in birds and mammals, may play an important role in these observed differences. McCarthy examined the levels of FOXP2 proteins in 4-day-old rat pups, and then compared those levels with the ultrasonic vocalizations that the pups made while in distress. She found that male pups not only had higher levels of FOXP2 in the cerebellum, amygdala, cortex, and thalamus, but they also produced nearly double the amount of vocalizations of female pups when separated from their mother. That led the mother rats to preferentially retrieve them over their female siblings. McCarthy wondered what might happen if they reduced the levels of FOXP2 in the pups. Using an intracerebroventricular injection, how's that for your word of the day, the researchers directly targeted the protein using a small interfering RNA that stops the brain cells from producing FOXP2. By decreasing FOXP2 in the pup, they eliminated the sex difference. As expected, the siRNA-treated males showed a decreased number of vocalizations 2 days after the treatment. While males are the more verbose of rat pups, human children show exactly the opposite pattern. Females are the more verbose in humans. So McCarthy looked at levels of FOXP2 in postmortem tissue from 5 male and 5 female children with a mean age of 4 years old. They found human girls, unlike the rats, had a higher level of FOXP2 in the broadband area, a brain area associated with language, than human boys did. McCarthy said, quote, "These results could speak toward the evolutionary development of language. We see FOXP2 expressed differently in male and female rat pups, as well as in a small number of human subjects." Unquote. McCarthy hopes to extend the findings. She's currently trying to determine the role that sex hormones may play in the expression of FOXP2 in the brain and how that may affect vocalization. Next story. Okay, I don't know how many of you are Spider-Man fans, but there is an ongoing sort of villain in the Spider-Man comics, and actually he just appeared in the recent mediocre teen angsty Amazing Spider-Man movie, Dr. Kurt Connors. Dr. Connors was actually a good guy. And depending on what version of the comics you read, he was either an independent researcher or a college professor. Peter Parker actually worked as his lab assistant at one point in one of the versions of the comics. Connors was a gifted surgeon who enlisted in the army and was sent off to war. He performed emergency battlefield surgery on wounded GIs, but his right arm was injured in a blast and had to be amputated. After his return to civilian life as a biology researcher, Connors became obsessed with uncovering the secrets of reptilian limb regeneration. Working from his home in the Florida Everglades, he finally developed an experimental serum taken from reptilian DNA. He successfully regrew the missing limb of a rabbit and then chose to test it on himself. Connors ingested the formula and his missing arm did indeed grow back. However, the formula had a side effect. Connors was subsequently transformed into a reptilian humanoid monster, who was dubbed the Lizard by the Daily Bugle. Spider-Man discovered Connors' situation during a trip to Florida and was eventually able to use Connors' notes to create an antidote to restore him to his human form and mentality. Okay, what does any of this foray into the geeky side of me have to do with actual science? Well, Dr. Thomas Braun of the Max Planck Institute for Heart and Lung Research, as the author of a new paper published January 20th in Genome Biology, that Dr. Kurt Connors would probably have really appreciated. When a newt loses a leg, or part of its heart or eye, among other organs, it can replace the missing body part by turning on genes that coax new cells to grow. Knowing how this process works on the molecular level could help treat human disease. but the identities of the genes involved have largely remained a mystery. Now, Braun has made inroads into this field by combining methods to pinpoint genes with increased expression during the regeneration process, along with their corresponding proteins. This new approach enabled identification of several new proteins that have never been found in other organisms. So Braun's team focused on the transcriptome, the NUT, that is the collection of all the mRNA transcript molecules in the animal's cells. Much of the NUT's large genome, it is 10 times bigger than any mammal's, consisted of introns that are not actively translated into protein. The team assembled a transcriptome with 120,000 non-redundant transcripts that included transcripts from all stages of regeneration of various organs. Some of those transcripts were similar to those found in other organisms. But Braun and his colleagues wanted more information on specific proteins involved in regeneration, not just transcripts that may not necessarily get translated into proteins. So they isolated proteins from newt tissues, including heart, eye lens, tail, liver, and spleen, during regeneration. They characterized the proteins using mass spectrometry and then compared the protein sequences with the transcripts they found. The researchers found 55,000 peptides that matched up with 14,000 transcripts from their earlier experiments. More than 10,000 transcripts encoded multiple proteins, and more than 500 peptides have not been identified in any other organism previously. Braun said, quote, "It was indeed a surprise that there are numerous new genes not found in other organisms. Whether this is directly correlated with regenerative capacity, we don't know yet," unquote. For now, the results don't give an immediate answer to how newts and related animals mediate the regeneration of any body parts, but instead it offers a starting point for scientists who have lacked concrete genetic data on the amphibians before. So Dr. Connors may have to wait a while yet to get that arm regenerated without turning into a giant lizard, and we may not be all that far off from when such a feat will be possible. Since we are on the topic of pop culture and regeneration, let's talk $6 Million Man for just a second. In the original 1970s TV show, Steve Austin was an astronaut who was deathly injured in an accident and had two legs and one arm and an eye replaced by cybernetic parts. One of the problems I've always had with the show was in the credits, when they show the schematics of the bionic eye. They showed an electronic eye built backwards into the head, along with an electronic optic nerve and a new electronic optic tectum section to be fused into the brain. I was never able to figure out how Colonel Austin could see with that much machinery being jiggered into his head. I never understood the interface, and it turns out I'm not alone. In the Journal of Experimental Biology this month, Dr. Douglas Blackiston from Tufts University explains why he thinks we would have trouble attaching an eye to the brain when there is no longer an optic nerve. And he has a solution to it. Here is what Blackiston says as he states his problem. Quote, "Implanting an artificial or biological replacement eye would require connecting it to the nervous system in some way. For those with damaged optic nerves or those missing the eye completely, retinal implants are not possible treatment options," unquote. So see, that's exactly my problem with Steve Austin's bionic eye. No eye or optic nerve. So here's the question. If connection through the optic nerve is not possible, could replacement eyes connect somewhere else? And just how hardwired are our nervous systems to expect data from specific organs in predetermined locations? Blackiston realized that he could use blind Xenopus tadpoles to investigate how adaptable the brain and central nervous system is to receiving information from abnormally located eyes, what are commonly called ectopic organs. To begin, Blackiston induced blindness in the tadpoles by surgically removing their eyes, with some of the blinded amphibian patients also receiving donor eyes that were transplanted onto unusual positions along their torsos and tails near the spine. Even though it sucked to graft over 200 tiny donor eyes, the next step was even worse. Blackiston needed to develop a test to determine whether the transplanted ectopic eyes allowed the blind tadpoles to actually see. He said, quote, "While physiology can show that an eye sends electrical signals in response to light, a behavioral regime is necessary to show that the brain is receiving such data and processing the information in a meaningful way," unquote. After nearly a year of hard work, he came up with a sight test. He placed the amphibious subjects in a well where half of the dish was illuminated with red light and the other half with blue light, which they inverted at regular intervals. During training sessions, whenever the tadpoles ventured into areas bathed in red light, they received a little warning zap of electricity. After a break, the tadpoles were tested to see whether they had learnt to associate the red light with electrical punishment and whether they would stick to the blue side of the dish. While the blind tadpoles never showed a preference for blue light, six tadpoles with donor eyes behaved like their full-sighted relatives and showed a learnt desire to remain in the safe, blue-illuminated areas. These fortunate six tadpoles obviously were able to see through their new ectopic eyes. Of the 134 tadpoles, only 24% had traceable neurons extending toward the spine. It was within that latter group that the six lucky tadpoles with a color vision fell. Blackiston said, quote, "The tadpole's ability to see when ectopic eyes are connected to the spinal cord and not directly to the brain was stunning. I believe that future biomedical treatments for sensory or motor disorders may not need to target the original brain locations to restore function. It is clear that our findings could radically change our future approach to regenerative medicine for a wide range of disorders," unquote. So this has to lead me to wonder, when a kid in the future says that his mom has eyes in the back of her head, you may have to take him literally at that. The next story of the night is about smart cells. Synthetic biologists have finally created bacterial cells that can perform logic functions and store the results. Dr. Timothy Liu, an electrical engineer, and his team have built the first circuits in bacterial cells that combine both basic aspects of computing, logic functions and memory. They're able to encode data permanently into DNA, and that data has been passed on through 90 generations of bacteria. In 2009, Liu and his colleagues designed a synthetic gene circuit in E. coli that could count up to 3. Their system utilized a chain of enzymes called recombinases that activated 3 genes in a row, like a line of dominoes to count. Using that work as their inspiration, Liu designed new circuits that use the recombinases to cut out stretches of DNA, flip them, and insert them back into the genome. In that context, flipping a piece of DNA up or down is like turning it on or off, or a 1 or a 0 in binary code. If 2 bits of DNA bookend a piece of regulatory DNA, like a promoter that activates a gene, the bits act as a 2-input logic gate, detecting multiple inputs and then outputting an answer. In this case, the output would be either the gene is activated or the gene is not activated. Because the actual DNA of the bacterial genome is stably altered, the input is stored as permanent memory. The team demonstrated that the cells retain the memory for at least 90 generations, as I stated a little while ago. Applying their technique, they built a system in which recombinases targeted DNA sequences around promoters for a gene-controlling green fluorescent protein production. They created 16 two-input Boolean logic functions in individual cells. In one instance, for example, the recombinases flip both target DNA sequences on, and the promoter activates the GFP gene, and the cell expresses GFP and begins to glow. Once the sequences are flipped, they can't be returned to their original state. So if Liu wanted to read the cell's history of inputs, he could either measure the cell's GFP output and deduce the inputs, or sequence the cell's DNA where the data is stored. Liu says, quote, "A genetic circuit with logic and memory could be used to track whether disease-related genes are turned on and off in an organism as a way to study disease progression. Or in biotechnology, the system could be used to program a cell to produce a drug at a certain level, eliminating the need for constantly stimulating the cell, and future offspring of the cell would also produce the drug," unquote. I'm just imagining the actual cellular smartphones that people will get injected into their heads very soon. No more fumbling for that big clumsy phone from your purse or jacket. No more ringing, bothering anybody nearby. It'll all be in your head. Just pay your bills on time, though, or AT&T will give you an antibiotic to kill your new cell phone off. The final story of the night comes from the 20th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections that's taking place this week in Atlanta. This story is based on a talk given by Dr. Deborah Persaud of Johns Hopkins University. The oral seminar was entitled, Is There Hope for HIV Eradication? And I guess there may be. I'm always leery of claims of any kind of viral cure. So far in human history, the only viral cures that have been pulled off have been with the immune system. We have damn fine treatments now for all sorts of nasty retroviruses like HIV and herpes, but still no cures. Given that, Dr. Persaud and her colleagues report on an infant whose exposure to HIV was confirmed through review of maternal HIV antibody and plasma viral load tests, including HIV drug resistance testing. The infant infection was documented using standard HIV enzymatic methods and plasma viral loads. The baby was treated with the full spectrum of antiviral and antiretroviral agents available. Although HIV was clearly detected in the baby for the first 2 months of life, a viral load dropped to almost nothing by the second month of antiviral treatment. Now for the interesting part. When they stopped the antiviral treatment at 26 months of age, no viral load was detected in blood, and no HIV-specific antibodies were detected with any standard clinical assays. In short, the child showed no signs of infection and appeared to be in a state of functional HIV cure. The authors concluded with the following statement, quote, "This cure in an HIV child suggests that very early antiviral treatment may prevent establishment of a latent reservoir and achieve a cure in children," unquote. I think that's great, and it does give some hope to kids infected with HIV when they're born. But I am wondering why we are not seeing more of these child cures. Surely every child born with an HIV infection is being given antiviral treatments. If this group is reporting on it, then a complete cure must be very rare, and we're not seeing a lot of these children being treated with the antiviral treatments getting better. Not to be a gloomy Gus here, but I'm just wondering whether the situation isn't more complicated than Dr. Persaud is making out. It is possible that this one child is the rarity, and that there aren't going to be too many more who are going to be cured in quite the same way. On the other hand, I could be wrong, and perhaps this is the beginning of a trend with new drugs being able to help these children. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Don't self-publish your science manuscripts or inject lizard serum, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.